thanks for returning to great speeches and interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and we're just listening to radio host Scott Horton interview the other Scott Horton, and they're talking about the conflict between the executive branch and the Congress concerning the report on CIA torture and how the Justice Department is interfering with the investigation.
Well, and again, like you're saying, that they would do this to Dianne Feinstein. Boy, and I guess she doesn't hold grudges. They're not worried about that, or what, these guys?
I think they have to be. And you look at Rogers on the House side, who also, I'd say, you know, hard to find a chair of the House Select Committee who has been as much of a rigorous defender of the CIA as he has been, and yet even he has been pressed to be critical of them at length. I mean, they've just gone totally off the reservation in the way they're behaving.
Yeah. Well, you know, to be hyperbolic about it a little bit, it does sort of seem like, well, you know, come on. The Congress is sort of a ceremonial debating society kind of a thing. And the reality is, as Julian Assange put it about the NSA, that they're the ones who wear the pants in the relationship between the elected government and the actual government of the United States, the executive agencies that implement the laws. And so when it comes down to it, I mean, maybe it's a bad faux pas, but is it really inaccurate that the CIA is a bigger, more powerful force than the U.S. Senate? In reality, like, you could see why it makes sense from the point of view of the CIA's lawyer, is what I mean. That, like, well, what's she going to do about it? She's just a senator. I'm the CIA's lawyer, you know?
Well, and conversely, I mean, I think Dianne Feinstein, in the speech she gave, she said, you know, this is a death of the republic sort of issue. And that may sound melodramatic. It's absolutely correct. I mean, you know, writers about these issues, going back to people like Max Weber writing at the end of World War One. I mean, he said basically the test of whether a republic stands up in the modern age includes whether the parliament, whether Congress exercises mastery over state secrecy. If they don't do that, and if they don't perform or discharge their oversight functions, you're not a democratic form of government. That's the bottom line here.
And there was hardly a call for Brennan to have to resign. The president took Brennan's side, and then the whole thing kind of blew over, right?
He sort of did and sort of didn't. I mean, he was rather ambiguous. So he was he did not criticize Brennan. He did not criticize the CIA. He was asked several times. He blew off the questioners. And then he placed a whole series of off-the-record phone calls to leaders in the Senate and the House, particularly those who were proponents of the report, assuring them, send it on over to me, I'll declassify it, and you'll be able to publish it. So he refused to criticize Brennan, and he appeared to be backing him, but then he told Congress, no, he was going to side with them at the end of the day. It's he's trying to walk on both sides of the line right now, and I guess the proof will be at the end of the day, does he declassify and authorize publication, and what are the redactions? We'll just have to see how that turns out.
Right. But, yeah, I see what you mean. This may have backfired on Brennan because politically it meant Obama had to do something, so he went ahead and said, well, we'll do the declassification instead of having the CIA do it, or with the CIA, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, this was not a good a good week for John Brennan, that's for sure. I mean, I think he comes out of this looking pretty bad.
All right, and then, so what do you make of Edward Snowden's revelations lately and the state of the law there? What do you think, for example, about the Freedom Act? Do you think that has any chance in the Senate of being passed?
I think increasingly, I mean, I really see a tide rising gradually against the government on these issues. I mean, if you look at public opinion polling from the time that Snowden left and the first disclosures occurred until today, you see a steady, gradual erosion of confidence in the U.S. government and its claims about surveillance, and a steady rise in apprehension about the national surveillance state. So that translates slowly into political pressure for changes and reforms. I would say it's certain we're going to get some changes. I would just be very much afraid of the Trojan horse. That is, we get something that looks like a reform act, but when you get deep inside of it, you find out it's not that at all. And that's what Washington is quite expert in producing.
Right, yeah. Well, if we got one good thing going for us, it's that I believe Greenwald's book is coming out here in a little while, so he must have saved some good stuff for that. Maybe that'll make a splash and have some shocking stories. They keep saying, oh, the worst is yet to come. Just you wait. So I guess we'll see, Scott. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. It's great to talk to you again.
Great pleasure to be with you.
All right, everybody. That is the other Scott Horton. Heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, the oldest continuously published magazine in America. Yeah, harpers.org.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Following the Desert Storm victory, George H.W. Bush addresses a joint session of Congress on March 6, 1991.
Mr. President, it is customary at joint sessions for the chair to present the president to the members of Congress directly and without further comment. But I wish to depart from tradition tonight and express to you, on behalf of the Congress and the country, and through you to the members of our armed forces, our warmest congratulations on the brilliant victory of the Desert Storm operation. Members of the Congress, I now have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Mr. President and Mr. Speaker, thank you, sir, for those very generous words spoken from the heart about the wonderful performance of our military. Members of Congress, 5 short weeks ago, I came to this House to speak to you about the State of the Union, and we met then in time of war. Tonight, we meet in a world blessed by the promise of peace. From the moment Operation Desert Storm commenced on January 16th, until the time the guns fell silent at midnight 1 week ago, this nation has watched its sons and daughters with pride, watched over them with prayer. As Commander-in-Chief, I can report to you our armed forces fought with honor and valor. And as President, I can report to the nation, aggression is defeated, the war is over. This is a victory for every country in the coalition, for the United Nations, a victory for unprecedented international cooperation and diplomacy, so well led by our Secretary of State, James Baker. It is a victory for the rule of law and for what is right. Desert Storm's success belongs to the team that so ably leads our armed forces. Our Secretary of Defense, and our chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Dick Cheney and Colin Powell. This military victory also belongs to the one the British call the man of the match, the Tower of Calm at the eye of Desert Storm, General Norman Schwarzkopf. And let us, recognizing this was a coalition effort, let us not forget Saudi General Khalid, Britain's General de la Billière, our General Roque Joffre of France, and all the others whose leadership played such a vital role. And most importantly of all those who served in the field. I thank the members of this Congress. Support here for our troops in battle was overwhelming. And above all, I thank those whose unfailing love and support sustained our courageous men and women. I thank the American people. The consequences of the conflict in the Gulf reach far beyond the confines of the Middle East. Twice before in this century, an entire world was convulsed by war. Twice this century, out of the horrors of war, hope emerged for enduring peace. Twice before, those hopes proved to be a distant dream beyond the grasp of man. Until now, the world we've known has been a world divided, a world of barbed wire and concrete block, conflict, Cold War. Now we can see a new world coming into view, a world in which there is the very real prospect of a new world order. In the words of Winston Churchill, a world order in which the principles of justice and fair play protect the weak against the strong. A world where the United Nations, freed from Cold War stalemate, is poised to fulfill the historic vision of its founders. A world in which freedom and respect for human rights find a home among all nations. The Gulf War put this new world to its first test. And my fellow Americans, we passed that test for the sake of our principles, for the sake of the Kuwaiti people. We stood our ground because the world would not look the other way. Ambassador El-Saba, tonight, Kuwait is free. Where is it? When I spoke in this House about the state of our union, I asked all of you, if we can selflessly confront evil for the sake of good in a land so far away, then surely we can make this land all that it should be. In the time since then, the brave men and women of Desert Storm accomplished more than even they may realize. They set out to confront an enemy abroad, and in the process, they transformed a nation at home. Think of the way they went about their mission, with confidence and quiet pride. Think about their sense of duty, about all they taught us, about our values, about ourselves. We hear so often about our young people in turmoil, how our children fall short, how our schools fail us, how American products and American workers are second class. Well, don't you believe it. The America we saw in Desert Storm was first-class talent. I'm sure that many of you saw on the television the unforgettable scene of four terrified Iraqi soldiers surrendering. And they emerged from their bunker, broken, tears streaming from their eyes, fearing the worst. And then there was an American soldier. Remember what he said? He said, "It's okay. You're all right now. You're all right now." That scene says a lot about America, a lot about who we are. Americans are a caring people. We are a good people, a generous people. Let us always be caring and good and generous in all we do.
Time was when an American about to go abroad would be warned by his friends or the guidebooks not to drink the water. But times have changed, and now a foreigner coming to this country might be offered the following advice.
Visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware: don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution, they got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. See the halibuts and the sturgeons are being wiped out by detergents. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, but they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste. Just go out for a breath of air, and you'll be ready for Medicare. The city streets are really quite a thrill. If the hoods don't get you, the monoxide will. Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. Then you can breathe, long as you don't inhale. Lots of things there that you can drink, but stay away from the kitchen sink, the breakfast garbage that you throw into the bay. They drink at lunch in San Jose. So go to the city, see the crazy people there, like lambs to the slaughter. They're drinking the water and breathing the
One of the most powerful ways to figure out how the Earth will respond to all the carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere is to look back at Earth's history. Paleontologists have spent a lot of time trying to understand a time more than 50 million years ago when the planet was much hotter than it is today. NPR's Richard Harris reports that the news is not all bad when you take the long view.
About 10 million years after the dinosaurs died out, the Earth suffered another huge ecological shock. Carbon dioxide levels in the air soared. The oceans turned more acidic as carbon dioxide dissolved in the water and turned into carbonic acid. And that's happening again thanks to our use of fossil fuels. Dick Norris, a paleontologist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, has been trying to figure out what this means for our near future.
Looking in the geologic past, and also, of course, using models to forecast the future, is a little bit like looking into a house through dirty windows or something. You don't get all the details of what's going on there, but you get sort of the gist.
He and some colleagues review that deep history in today's issue of Science magazine. The bad news from the greenhouse event 56 million years ago is a lot of life in the deep ocean simply went extinct, either from getting too warm, not having enough oxygen, or both. Coral also took a hit, but not as bad.
The reefs disappear, but we don't think it was an extinction of reef corals. Rather, it was the reef corals being outcompeted by other kinds of organisms during this much warmer period of Earth history.
Algae that didn't mind the heat and acidity may simply have taken over the reefs and left them flat and boring ecosystems. But the coral laid low for millions of years until conditions improved again for the majestic branching coral we see today. Paul Falkowski at Rutgers University is also fascinated with this period of Earth history. He notes that the prehistoric hot spell prevented ocean waters at the surface from circulating into the deep. And that's something he worries could happen again in a sharply warmer world.
That would lead to a major change in the cycling of many elements on the planet, such as nitrogen, sulfur, carbon, and so on.
Those nutrient cycles don't just affect what happens in the ocean, they affect life on land in surprising and unpredictable ways, as gases flow from the sea into the air. For example, it was during this ancient hot spell that grasses spread across the earth, and along with that, the grazing animals that depend on them.
It's hard to believe that a horse could be the size of a chihuahua, but horses started out about that size and evolved to be, because of the rise of grasses, the animals that we commonly associate them to be today, large animals.
In short, it was a time of upheaval with both winners and losers. The wild card now is that these changes are happening so fast, it's likely to be harder for species to adapt or evolve. And Dick Norris at Scripps says that the pace and severity of the change depends on how long we continue to burn fossil fuels and allow all that carbon dioxide to flood into the air and the ocean.
If we wait, even a fairly short period of time, like 80 years, to deal with greenhouse gases and the global change problem, then we end up with these really remarkably long ecological impacts on Earth, where it takes, 20,000 years to sort of start to readjust back to something we would be familiar with now.
But he says if we switch quickly to cleaner sources of energy, the world could remain much more like the planet we depend upon today. Richard Harris, NPR News.
First they occupied our country, then they spread their vicious lies. Evil propaganda filled our ranks with double-dealing spies. They cordoned off a reservation, built a wall all around it, drove us all into this ghetto, and our city'd never be as the Nazis found it. First no one believed just what horrors lay in store. The sound of boots upon the staircase, of leather gloves upon the door. Some of us they sent to labor, to slave for them to the last breath. Most of us they sent to Auschwitz, 500,000 people sent to a pointless early death. There were those of us who worked with them, a desperate effort to survive. Even when our numbers were so few, maybe 60,000 left alive. People said we had no chances. By then we all knew they were right. It was 1943, and we, the Walking Dead, made up our minds to fight. I remember Warsaw. We stood side by side. The Star of David flew above the ghetto. There we lived and there we died. We cleansed the ghetto of their agents, dug a maze of tunnels underground. We begged the Allies give us weapons, but empty words was all we found. So we saved each precious bottle, made bombs of rags and gasoline. And in this script of mindless carnage, we waited in the shadows for the final scene. It was the month of April. The SS came marching in, singing songs to praise Der Führer and all his Aryan kin. To see the shock upon their faces, we'd show the world on this day we'd not go like sheep off to the slaughter. With the last blood running through our hearts, we'd make the devils pay. I remember Warsaw. We stood side by side. The Star of David flew above the ghetto. There we lived and there we died. Each escape route planned. We rained down Molotovs upon them. With each retreat, another stand. Yes, we killed the Nazi bastards. They lay dying by the score. We made each scarce bullet count. And as the demons ran, we killed some more. For one full month, the battle raged. And the word spread all around that it wasn't over till every building had been leveled to the ground. I am the ghost of the apocalypse, and these few words I have to tell. Let it never be forgotten that for 4 long weeks we fought, we stood up before we fell. I remember Warsaw. We stood side by side. The Star of David flew above the ghetto. There we lived and there we died.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome to this meeting, which is of the utmost importance. But before we begin, let us please bow our heads and give thanks to the great Almighty One, the knower of all things, the Omniscient One. All hail Alan Greenspan! Bum, 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 Mr. Greenspan.
Yes?
Give us a clue.
Bum, 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 bum.
We buy our stocks based on the things that you do.
Bum, 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 bum.
You scratch your butt, so we're now surmising. The stock and preparation age is rising. Greenspan. We heard you sneeze.
Bum, 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 bum.
Buy Kleenex futures from here to Belize. Robitussin's riding high. Mr. Greenspan.
I'm the mean man. I'll make it clear. The leading economic indicators based on third world acquisition of durable products show moderate rise in supply and fall in demand for dry goods this year. I am so smart when I'm speaking freely. I explain the global ramifications of the economic sanctions on emerging markets versus expanding markets like I'm speaking in Swahili.
Mr. Greenspan.
What?
We're in a fix. Most of our stocks are dropping faster than bricks.
Here's the reason you're not calm. You'll know you'll be crying if the stocks you're buying have a name that ends in dot.
Com, 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 dum, 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 dum.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.